It's Maria.
And this is Jordan. Welcome back to Major Musings.
Welcome back. How's it going, Jordan?
Pretty good. Yeah, not too bad. How about you?
I'm doing okay. So for those listening, we did push back the release date for this episode.
Mm-hmm.
Because, well, Jordan is moving next week. And had we stuck to our original schedule, she would have had to work on an episode while she was moving. So that's why we delayed this one.
And then you were feeling a little under the weather last week, too. So it ended up working out better for both of us.
It's not COVID, folks. I promise. I just had a cold.
Yeah.
So I wasn't feeling well, so it just worked out. Today is August 4th. So I'm feeling a lot of things. I didn't expect that we'd be recording on August 4th, but it is the 1 year anniversary of the explosion that took place in, like, back home in Lebanon. It's the end of the day now, so, but it's definitely been a lot, looking at social media posts, people I know going to the vigil or the protest back home. So, I don't know, a lot of feelings. And it's interesting because, you know, the artist that I'm talking about today, she's not Lebanese, but there's this one project of hers where the way she describes something that happened in her home country, the timing of reading that and the anniversary was it was interesting timing. So I'm looking forward to talking about that at least. So
yeah. So another little coincidence with us pushing the recording back, I guess. Yeah.
It worked out.
Yeah. All right. Then if you're ready to go, I'm excited to hear about this artist.
All right. Yeah, I'm ready. So my artist this week, her name is Hana Malala. So I mentioned this in the previous episode that I have been in contact with a relative of mine who has this online platform called Artzotic, and Hana is one of the artists that she represents. She is an Iraqi artist, researcher, and educator based in London. She was born in 1958 in Iraq. She studied painting at the Academy of Fine Arts in Baghdad. And then get this, she later earned, her MA and PhD are both from the University of Baghdad. Her MA was in semiotics. Her PhD was in logic.
Oh.
Yeah.
Interesting. Okay.
Very interesting. And when you read her writing, she is her fascination with mathematics, especially with respect to mathematics, symbols, and logic with respect to ancient Mesopotamia is a driving force in her work. And that's because, for those who don't know, modern-day Iraq was ancient Mesopotamia. So the history of that civilization is something that she grew up learning about and lived in. And, you know, she visited the museums there quite often and educated herself. In her graduate work, obviously, since she picked an MA in semiotics, she developed a semiotic approach to art.
Mm-hmm.
And her doctorate, she received it in 2005. Her thesis was about using forms of logic elaborated by modern philosophy to examine the art of ancient Mesopotamia.
Wow.
Yeah. And so a lot of this, I don't know, I feel like if I were to have a conversation with her about this kind of stuff, I wouldn't even be able to begin to wrap my head around it all.
Yeah.
I mean, imagine a PhD in logic. It's very impressive. Yes. And it's such a fascinating combination of, you know, the fine arts, her background in painting as an undergrad, to, you know, graduate studies in semiotics and logic. One of the ways that she's recognized in that sense is her signature in her artworks. She calls it her signature as number. And, I mean, literally, her signature is numbers.
Oh.
She started doing this in 2007. And it's based on the Abjad system, where each number corresponds to an Arabic letter.
Okay.
Yeah. So traditionally, the Abjad system allows letters and words to be analyzed as if they were numbers, and that's why she kind of started doing that.
Hmm.
Her signatures are very multi-layered in content, and she's kind of developed them over the 30 years of her practice to reach the point of doing it in 2007, officially. Conceptually, it's rooted in her interests in abstract systems and their equivalents, and, you know, beginning with early Mesopotamian shapes, Islamic charts, and research undertaken in her graduate coursework. And one of the articles I was reading about, or I don't know if it was an interview, I can't fully remember right now, but I believe she said that she actually learned the shapes that Mesopotamians used to communicate with one another.
Oh my God.
Before letters were founded.
Wow.
Yeah. So she learned that just from a deep fascination for it and wanting to be able to recognize that quote unquote language. So
that's amazing.
I know. It, you know, some people applaud others for learning Latin. Meanwhile, she's like, I'm going to learn Mesopotamian shapes.
So, yeah, honestly. Oh,
very impressive. And, you know, much of her early work, which was produced in Iraq, incorporated mathematics. She actually recalls this time in her career and says that maybe it may have come off as dry or too intellectual, but she claims that she enjoyed the purity of numbers and the protection afforded by its impenetrable languages.
Hmm.
And I thought this was such an interesting perspective that she had on numbers and on mathematics, because if you really, I guess if you want to take a psychological kind of analytic approach to this, she grew up in Iraq, so she grew up around war,
mm-hmm.
and just the irrational human behavior of just violence and greed and power and this kind of what felt like an irreconcilable conflict. So in that environment, she was drawn to the logic and to the mathematics. And again, she says, you know, there's this protection afforded by a language that's impenetrable. You know, math is math.
Yeah.
There is no what ifs. There's no blurred lines. It's a yes or no kind of thing. And I think it definitely makes sense when you consider where she grew up.
Yeah. It's hard to make math something political.
Exactly. There are clear answers there. There's nothing to think about, you know? And so that's what kind of was the overarching theme in her work, and in many ways continues to be a theme in her work. During her time in Iraq, she also taught at the Institute of Fine Arts and the University of Baghdad. She left the country at the end of 2006 for an artist residency at the Institut du Monde Arabe in Paris, which translates to the Institute of the Arab World in Paris, or World Arab Institute. And that was followed by fellowships at the School of Oriental and African Studies at the Chelsea College of Art in London. In recent years, she's taught at the Royal University for Women in Bahrain, but she lives right now in London, and she's based in London.
Okay.
So, since the early 1990s, Malala has tried to think through destruction as an essential part of the human condition, treating the material she works with as found objects that she mutilates or disfigures according to what she came to conceptualize in 2007 and what she is best known for now as the ruins technique.
Oh.
So a little bit of backstory about the ruins technique. She remained in Iraq during periods of violence, lawlessness, travel restrictions, all of which ultimately affected her investigation of concepts of homeland, spirituality, and ruin in her art practice. One of the ways that this happened was that art materials became sparse because of sanctions imposed on Iraq in the 90s. So many artists were affected. And her ruins technique became a popular method amongst Hedai artists, all of whom turned to items found in their surroundings. Burnt paper, torn cloth, barbed wire, splintered wood, bullets, anything in the environment.
Wow.
And, you know, this reflection on destruction drew on Malala's research on semiotics, on the material culture of ancient Mesopotamia. But more recently, it has shifted its focus from objects to landscapes. So she kind of talks about exploring the virtual aspects of destruction, the temporality of decay, the survival of material, and the paradoxical appearance of invisibility within the invisible. So her research on this virtual destruction has led her more recently to examine the relationship between spiritualism and technology. And, you know, one aspect of Malala's philosophy, which I find particularly fascinating, is the way she approaches her identity and, you know, this aspect of spirituality, as well as the ways in which, you know, critics may have tended to describe her work with respect to her identity. And this applies to the ruins technique as well. So in an interview with Ruba Asfahani for the website Culture Trip, Asfahani asks Malala whether the title of being one of Iraq's leading contemporary female artists meant anything to her or held some kind of weight. And Malala said the following: "I don't like to use the terms male or female artist. I think of art without gender or nationality or identity. Provided their artworks function well technically and conceptually, then why shouldn't Middle Eastern artists be considered in the same category as Western artists? I don't care about titles like leading female. When I work in my studio, I forget my gender. I consider labels like that restricting, and I don't want any limits or boundaries to what I can do." And she's even said in many instances that she has thrived in exile from Iraq because everything that she was influenced by in Iraq was based on, like, very traditional notions of art. And being in London, she's been exposed to artists internationally. So she's very grateful for that, which I think is very interesting because, you know, many other artists that I've talk about the conflicting feelings they have about living in exile, whereas she more or less has kind of embraced it. And in that same interview, she talks about the ruins technique, and she asserts her stance on identity in that respect, saying, "I developed the ruins technique because I was in Iraq, not because I am Iraqi. I am influenced by the place and not by my identity."
Okay.
Yeah, so Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say it's very much more based on, like, the environment and the objects and materials available to her, not because of who she is.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, like she was, regardless of her citizenship status, she was living in Iraq during a time of war, of lawlessness, and as a result of that environment, that's when she developed her technique. It hasn't she claims it has nothing to do with who I am as an Iraqi. It just, I was there, and because of being there during that time, this is what happened.
So now that she is based in London, does she consider the work that she produces now to be using the ruins technique, or no? Do you know?
I think that she's shifting from it more so nowadays, but I believe I was going to talk about this later, bit later as well, but essentially, with the ruins technique, she says that, you know, even though I continued my practice in London, it's not so much work that addresses Iraq. It's a lot more broad than that now.
Okay.
So she kind of asserts that, you know, it's not about my country, just my country anymore. It's more than that.
Gotcha.
Is what she says. And, you know, this interview and everything that she said, you know, I found to be incredibly profound, and it's sort of put into words exactly what I've kind of been mulling over in my head when it came to talk about any of the artists I've discussed on this podcast. I feel like identity in art history is such a, I don't think sensitive is the right word. It's just, there's a specific narrative when it comes to discussions about identity in art history, and I feel like she challenges that by saying something like, I made this because I was in the country, not because I'm from the country.
Yeah.
Which is really interesting. So I feel like this is definitely something I'd want to, I don't know, maybe research further in grad school. So we'll see. Mm-hmm.
And it also seems a little different, too, than some of the other artists who, whether you've talked about them or we've talked about in class, mm-hmm. where, like, you know, they're given this label of, like, oh, an African artist or a Latin American artist, and they're trying to not ignore that label completely but push against mm-hmm. it. But she seems even different from, like, some of those other artists.
She's more against it than any of them have been. She's definitely more assertive in her interviews of, no, this is not what I'm trying to do,
mm-hmm.
which is interesting. Yeah. And, you know, while she refuses to be confined to titles such as woman or Iraqi or Arab artist, she is discussing or kind of tackling concern over the loss of Iraq's heritage, particularly the destruction of its libraries, the looting of the Baghdad National Museum following the U.S.-led invasion in 2003. These are prominent themes in her work, and they often carry kind of a residual scent of smoke. So, on the ruins technique, Malala comments on her burning, distressing, and obliterating of material in her compositions. Again, it's a technique that stems from the lethality of war. She emphasizes, however, that this technique is not a means of reproducing the idea of war, rather utilizing its intrinsically destructive process to engender the visceral experience of the reality of war, irrespective of its geographic or political particular. Yeah. So through seeing the destruction firsthand, she was struck by kind of the ephemeral nature of existence, and she came to believe that, and I quote here, ruination is the essence of all being, is what she believes.
Ruination, yes. Ruination, wow.
Yeah. So the space, it's very heavy. Her work is very heavy.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because, like, she doesn't shy away from that, but at the same time, there is so much power in it just as a work of art and just as abstract work of art.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, so the space between existence and obliteration, essentially, stemming from living through the war, was, interestingly enough, a space that she likened to that between the figurative and the abstract in her work. Which I think was an interesting comparison.
Yeah.
And her mathematical focus in postgraduate work also led her to conclude that, you know, all figuration is essentially made up of abstract symbols. Yeah. Oh, so she just, that's a PhD in logic, all right.
Yep, yeah. I'm like thinking about that more. I'm like, yeah, you're not wrong.
Yeah. And, you know, this dates back to ancient Mesopotamian semiotic symptoms, which she knew of quite well given her frequent visits to the National Museum there.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the act of destruction is crucial in her work because it kind of produces the waste materials needed prior to creation.
Mm.
So kind of taking these materials from her environment, mutilating them, but in that mutilation, there is creation of a final product, of a work of art, which is very fascinating.
Yeah. Yeah. So then, just a quick question, and you mm-hmm. might have kind of answered this already and it just went over my head, but is she, when she's creating the piece of work, is she using only materials that have already been, you know, let's say destroyed in some way, so like some, like, burned pages or whatever, and then literally just creating the work, or is she, like, using something that she's found and then further, like, destroying it to then
combination of both,
okay,
yeah,
okay.
So since the 70s, destruction itself has been the starting point of her creative process, and it's allowed her to explore the space between non-entity and entity and seeking the knowledge within.
Okay.
So she made artworks out of found objects and destroyed material, which obviously diverges from traditional artistic materials.
Mm-hmm.
It started as a conscious rejection of traditional materials, but like I said earlier, it became necessity because of right. sanctions imposed throughout the 90s. And, you know, to answer your earlier question, and again, I said I'd come back to this, once she left Daida in 2006, she continued making work using the ruins technique. However, she no longer considers its use to be connected to her personal experience in Daida.
Okay.
She instead sees it presently as, and I quote from her website here, a contemporaneous comment upon destruction and the inherent violent nature of the human condition worldwide.
Okay, so broadening her lens, kind of.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And I think, I guess, well, I'm going to continue talking about this a little bit, but I wanted to interject here with something. I think it's really interesting because there's this one artist whom I did a residency with 4 years ago now. My God, it's been so long. But his name is Jean Borossian, and he, around that time was when he started working with fire and smoke oh. in his career. And I always thought there's no one like him. Mm-hmm. But then, which is really exciting to stumble upon her because she's been doing this since the early 2000s, long before he ever did.
Yeah.
So I think that's really interesting. And I wonder whether he'd ever... I never had this conversation with him, but I wonder if he'd ever stumbled upon her work and just kind of maybe was inspired by it.
Yeah.
But, where, you know, the ruins technique... Oh, go ahead.
I was just going to say, where is he from? Was he from Lebanon?
He's originally Armenian, but a lot of Armenians fled to Lebanon after the genocide, so he grew up in Lebanon for a while.
Okay.
Yeah. And... so, you know, going back to Malala, again, the ruins technique permeates all of her work. If you look at her pieces, a lot of them have that effect. She kind of creates soft sculpture, burning the canvas. She makes pouches in them, filling them with ash, kind of eviscerating the very fabric of the artwork. Over time, she developed it into subcategories like the camouflage technique and the shroud technique. And in her works, she actually used taxidermy. Ooh. Like the one example is the hoopoe bird. And she talks about this being significance that the creature is dead and often dismembered, just like empty pouches and obsolete objects featured in works using the ruins technique.
Hmm.
And she describes these as, quote, abstraction rooted deeply in the reality of war and violence. Wow. So, yeah, it's very interesting, and again, it's very intense when you look at it, but there's such beauty in the abstraction of it, and it's so interesting when you look at a technique like that. She's burning canvas, burning cloth, kind of attaching it to the composition, and it ends up creating something so unique.
Mm-hmm. Do you know the scale, by chance, of any of these? And, I mean, they might vary a lot.
Yeah, so some of these, they vary. One of them is 21 by 21 inches. Another one I'm looking at is 67 by 82 inches.
Oh, okay.
So they vary.
Yeah.
Probably
based on what she's found around her and what she's exactly, yeah. kind of inspired by.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But, yeah, very interesting. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of a summary of her early career and the ruins technique, which she's best known for. She has several projects, and you can find many of them on her website. Her website is actually very extensive. It's primarily what I used to source information for this podcast
nice.
Episode. Yeah, so I wanted to touch on something she'd done more recently in 2019. It's called She, He Has No Picture. It's a wall installation, and this is what I was talking about at the beginning of the episode when I was like, oh, reading this on the one-year anniversary of the explosion back home, it's like, it's kind of funny that I found this project
mm-hmm.
during this time, but it's a wall installation commemorating the victims of the pre-dawn bombing of public shelter number 25 in the Al-Amriya neighborhood, I'm sorry if I'm butchering that, of Baghdad on February 13, 1991. So that day, without warning, two American F-117 planes each fired a laser-guided smart missile, instantly incinerating over 400 people. 408, if I'm right.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And I know. Shortly after, a small booklet was published listing the victims' names. Only 100 of them had photographic portraits accompanied by their names.
Oh.
The others just had a notice printed beside their names reading either "she has no picture" or "he has no picture."
Oh my God.
Yeah. So a couple months after the event, Malala and a friend went to visit the shelter. This was in 91.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this is long, and I've already done this in the previous episode that I did, but just her description of being in there, I couldn't trim this down.
Oh,
so
it's okay. Oh no.
I'm going to read this. I know.
I'm going to get teary. I already know.
No.
Okay.
I mean, I got pretty emotional. Oh. It's because, my God, like, just reading this, it's like, again, this hits really close to home because it's just reminding me of reading things when the explosion happened last year, and yeah. Now it's... Anyway, so here's what she said about going there. "It was dark, only dimly lit by the hole made by the missiles in the ceiling. A toxic smell of smoke and charred bodies permeated the air. Human remains fused into the very fabric of the interior by the intense heat of the explosions, and an uncanny panorama of scorch marks on walls and ceiling had created a horrific yet mesmerizing visual spectacle. Families had hung photographs of their loved ones and arranged some candles, creating makeshift shrines of remembrance and grief. People were praying, others crying. Some, like us, were simply silenced in shock and disbelief. The artist in me desired to take photographs, but during that pre-smartphone time, and Ada, we were living under stringent sanctions, and film was almost impossible to come by. There was no need. The images etched themselves deeply into my heart, and a strong desire to memorialize the dead of Al-Amiriyye took up residence in my soul."
Wow.
Yeah.
Even with just that description, I feel like you can so clearly get an idea of what that would have looked like, and just the horror and sadness
I know. It's
that's awful.
Yeah, and you know, she was committed to, again, like she said, to memorializing it.
Yeah.
And memorializing the victims. So over the years after that, she spent years accumulating files and related content with every annual commemoration of the explosion.
Wow.
Names of victims, pictures that weren't in the booklet originally, observations, comments, condemnations. She sourced their faces from the internet and worked off of copied screenshots.
Ugh.
Because she wanted all of them to have pictures, or as many of them as possible.
Mm-hmm.
Many were often blurred and flat. Each portrait was then built up layer upon layer into kind of bas-reliefs with burnt or signed calico, which is kind of thin cotton material with the texture of bandages.
Mm-hmm.
And, my God, when she said this, she said at times with that texture, she recalls it felt as though she were working with burning flesh. I know.
Oh my God.
Yeah. And with that texture, the portraits, they're kind of raised from the surface of the canvas. So the faces kind of assumed this illusion of three-dimensionality emerging through the material as though they were frozen in this penultimate moment before death.
Mm-hmm.
And this part, she talks about she was watching the video of the shelter exploding on YouTube. It's available as VR. Well, not just exploding, it's available just to see the ruins of it on VR. And she said that viewing it on her laptop in London, yanked her back to 1991 and propelled her into the studio.
Oh my, wait. Someone has made it into VR, like virtual reality?
Mm-hmm. Like this, the space of the ruins. I don't know if that's still available. This was her reading it, wow, watching it in the early 2000s, so.
That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't really want to look it up.
No.
But if any of our listeners are curious, I'm sure you can find something of that effect on YouTube.
Wow.
So yeah, so she, seeing it again, kind of reliving it from a laptop, made her want to do something about it as well.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways that she began with the project was using burnt fabric on a small canvas, and that's when she started to build the face of a victim who was a woman, whose image she downloaded from the internet. And the sentence, "she has no image" or "he has no image," was, she engraved them on the surface in Arabic, so it's mm-hmm. unintelligible to the non-Arabic reader. And these were cut into brass plates that were put between the portraits using a laser. And okay. she kind of, with the laser, she's referencing the technology mm. that helped deliver, with precision, the fatal bombs and consequently the deaths of those seeking refuge. Ugh. Yeah. So, again, very, very intense.
Yeah.
It's, and, you know, with her talking about kind of reliving it through her laptop, I remember when the explosion happened last year back home. I think for weeks, I just could not stop seeing a video of the explosion
mm-hmm.
on my Instagram, on my Facebook, everywhere. And I just kept replaying it and replaying it and replaying it. I just kind of, it was mind-numbing.
Yeah.
But it brought me to the point where I couldn't, I've unfollowed any accounts that post the video
mm.
because a lot of them are still posting very traumatic pictures online without any trigger warnings. And yeah. I, of course, if I ever posted something that was extreme on my social media, I always added a content warning or mm-hmm. a trigger warning, but I never thought it would affect me. And just waking up this morning and seeing certain posts, being afraid that they might lead to something, that they might show the explosion somehow, I could just feel myself kind of, I don't know what, like bracing tensing. Myself? Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. But, and then it, nothing ever did, but it's just, it's there in my head, mm-hmm. even though I wasn't even there to experience it.
Yeah.
It's such a bizarre feeling. But I don't know. There was some piece in doing research on this project on and on Malala's kind of perspective of the bombing that she witnessed, because a lot of what she described is how I feel. And, you know, it's a reminder of, even if you're at a distance, you can't forget these things.
Right. Or
it's there in your head. Mm-hmm. And it feels as though you were there. The focus of this project is the faces of the victims. And I'm pulling other quotes of hers because, again, I think she just words everything about this project so beautifully. But she says, you know, central to this project is the face of victims, of viewers, of the faceless, and its relevance to memory and mourning. I question the forms and physicality of the representation of the face and what it means in the era of the internet not to have one.
Mm.
The role of the human face is paramount in the social and mutually responsible encounter with the other. It is the locus of personhood and is capable of expressing meaning before a single word is spoken. Horror, pain, joy, vulnerability, and defiance may be conveyed simultaneously, and its presence, the face-to-face, is prohibitive of murder. After all, thou shalt not kill is a moral imperative intrinsic to all religions.
Mm-hmm.
And yet,
yeah.
408 yeah, like, were killed.
I feel like that's, yeah, that is really spot on, because it's like, if someone doesn't have, if there's no face to put with an identity, it's so much easier to just write that person off or to forget entirely. Yeah.
So much easier.
I did have a question, which maybe you you might have been planning to speak about this anyway, but so as part of the work, I'm looking at the picture now. I see obviously all of the portraits of the people's faces and the brass plates with the Arabic, but I'm seeing as well, I don't know if they're canvas or other material that have numbers written on them. I don't know if you found what that means or what it corresponds to.
So I did not find anything specific about the numbers, but if I were to guess, it probably has something to do with the way she signs her work with numbers.
Oh, okay.
I think it's maybe something along those lines. If it's not her signature, it's definitely a message that she's trying to get across using numbers.
Yeah.
What that is exactly, I don't know.
Yeah, and maybe she intended it to not have a meaning that is known to the viewer. I don't know. I just, considering her background that you were telling me about, I was like, oh, that's interesting. All those
numbers.
Yeah, no,
it definitely is. Again, I don't know. Maybe, again, it could be something that she's trying to say. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, I'm not entirely sure.
Yeah, that's okay.
But yeah, it's very... It's a lot. And I think given the significance of today, I'm having trouble kind of... finding the words to fully describe it, but
it's okay.
I don't know. Her work really resonated with me. Her kind of her perspective on identity and the way that she's perceived, whether it's in Ada or in London, and this artwork specifically, I thought I would conclude with something she said about it, which I thought was very interesting. She said, artists sometimes say about a particular artwork that it was simply channeled through them. I understand this now. 28 years after visiting the shelter and its horrors, I was suddenly ready. The material practice, which I have termed ruins technique, where the creative process begins with an act of destruction, has matured over the span of 3 decades. There is both an expansion and a synthesis of processes in this project, a revisiting of my love for portraiture, numbers and equivalents, secrets and codes, the virtual and the actual, relationships between concept, media, techniques, and content work with rhizomatic fluidity. In the end, however, this is an ethical endeavor and hopefully a restorative one.
Wow.
Yeah. So she does mention, you know, secrets and codes.
Yeah.
And numbers in the quote. So whatever it is that she's hiding.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I mean, I think she kind of sums it up herself beautifully, I'd say.
I know. Her writing is amazing. I mean, I just, once I started pulling quotes, I couldn't stop. But yeah, that's Hannah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Her work is forceful, I'd say, but very powerful and beautiful. So
I think that's a good way to describe it, yeah.
Yeah. Thank you for sharing.
Of course. Thanks for listening to me. I oftentimes ramble through this. But
No.
I hope you enjoyed it.
I did.
Hope the listeners did.
Yes.
So, yeah. All right, then. How about you? What are you sharing with us next time?
So for the next episode, I'm going to talk about an architect who I remembered learning about her when I was looking through pictures from our trip to Denmark, because there's an exhibition of her work at the Louisiana Museum.
Oh, I know where this is going.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, so her name is Tatiana Bilbao, and she's from Mexico City. She is primarily an architect, but she did a lot of other really cool, interesting work.
Amazing work, yeah.
Yeah, so I'm excited to revisit her stuff and do like a deep dive with her works, because I remember when we were there, we were both like, wow, this is very cool, very interesting.
We spent forever in her installation piece. You can walk around and literally be in it. That wasn't a mistake on my end, listeners. I actually meant it. We were in it.
Yeah.
Like yeah. A good hour.
That museum gave her a very large space to show her works and her studio's projects.
It was definitely one of the highlights of the trip. So I'm really excited to hear that you'll be sharing more about her.
Yeah, me too. I'm glad I remembered her. So should be a good episode.
Awesome. Well, thank you. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah.
To everyone else, thanks for listening. And I guess we'll see you in 2 weeks.
Yeah. See you then. Bye.
Bye.